I'm Carol Coletta, and this is Smart City. What makes a place feel like home? That's a question that design psychologist Dr. Toby Israel helps people explore by developing their environmental family trees. And we'll find out more about her methods today on Smart City. Former Indianapolis Mayor Steve Goldsmith, one of the best-known urban innovators, is working with Bring New Orleans Back. And we'll get a firsthand report from Steve on the problems and opportunities in that city. We'll be back to talk with our guest Toby Israel and Steve Goldsmith today on Smart City, right after this news. I'm Carol Coletta, and you're listening to Smart City. Dr. Toby Israel is a design psychologist and principal with Toby Israel Consulting. She is the author of Someplace Like Home, published by Wiley Academy Press. Toby, what is design psychology?
Design psychology is defined as the practice of architecture, planning, and interior design in which psychology is the principal design tool. Purpose of design psychology is to create not just aesthetically beautiful and functional places, but also emotionally and socially fulfilling places as well.
You make the point that we don't begin with a blank slate when we gravitate to the kind of place that feels like home. Tell me what you mean by that.
Well, that's absolutely right. We have something called an environmental autobiography, our own very personal past history of place. And I believe that we rework that past history of place, often unconsciously. We replicate it, we reject it, or do some combination of the two. So, for example, perhaps you or some of your listeners have had the experience where you're looking for a place to live, and you're looking and you're looking, and nothing seems quite right. And all of a sudden, you walk into a house, an apartment, and you say, yeah, that's it, this is the one. And it seems almost like an emotional response. And I say very often what's happening is a place from the past, a place in your memory, is resonating. It's similar to the place you're looking at now and making it seem just right.
But in my own case, and I'm certain you have a similar situation, I grew up in a small fieldstone house in a new, very in-town, but new subdivision. And then as an adult, created a big loft space in downtown Memphis. And I'm trying to think, what would be the relationship between those two?
Well, I say people not only replicate it, but they reject often their past history of place. So, for example, I grew up in a development house as well. And the place that I live in now is different from the place that I grew up in. And very often it's about, well, what did that place from the past mean to you? What did it signify? For example, if you were looking for a kind of more vibrant or exciting life, you may have been attracted to the city as something different.
It's interesting if I think about that neighborhood I grew up in and the neighborhood that I found later in life. Although the buildings themselves were very different, the neighborhoods were very similar in that they offered a lot of opportunities, a lot of destinations close by that I could walk to, I could bike to, that I felt were very much part of my scene.
Well, this idea of environmental autobiography operates not just in choice of home, but in choice of larger scale place like city or town or neighborhood as well.
In your book, Someplace Like Home, you report interviews with three prominent people in the world of architecture: architect Michael Graves, architect and town planner Andre Estuani, and architecture critic Charles Jinks. What did you learn about the connections that they had made between their pasts and their current work?
Well, yeah, I mean, it was interesting because having taken other people, people on the street kind of thing, through exercises that I do in order to understand more about people's past history of place, I sat back and thought, well, okay, it would be interesting to see not just how each of one of us repeats or rejects the past, but what about famous people in the world of design? Everybody has an environmental past, an environmental autobiography, even designers. And I wondered how that influenced their sense of taste and style, which in turn influences us. So actually, first, since the book was to be published in England, I wrote to Prince Charles and asked him if he wanted to go through my exercises, but he politely declined. So instead, I turned to these three other figures in the world of design. And lo and behold, found that, yes, they amazingly had recreated their past history of place to a startling extent, and very much unconsciously. Very often what happened is that people look towards their grandparents' houses, and this was true in the case of these famous design figures as well. They hadn't thought about their grandparents' houses in years, yet when we went forward and started comparing the past grandparents' house to the present, we saw that there were lots of connections. And that, in fact, many of their famous buildings, communities, or design philosophies could be traced all the way back to those family roots.
Give me a specific example with Michael Graves or Andre Estuani.
Well, I could read a portion from the book, part of the interview with Duani. He says, for example, "Well, actually, to tell you the truth, this is interesting. My grandmother and grandfather lived in a perfect courtyard house when I was a child, and I would visit them. I remember it. They had a courtyard house, a patio house, exactly as I'm describing it, present to the downtown, and then a wonderful treed courtyard inside. It's part of my experience, absolutely. Yes, I remember the patio." And I ask him what he remembers, and he says, "Well, just like photographs, the surrounding columns, the trees in it, the mango tree. It was destroyed later. It was sold to a printer, who then covered the patio to make a factory. So I never actually saw it after I was 3 years old." But I say, "But you remember it?" And he says, "Yes, I think I could draw it." And he begins to draw a diagram. And I ask him what he has. And he says, "Okay, you enter here. This was called the Zanguan. Bedrooms were on this side. The kitchen was here. There was a tress patio, a service patio in the back. I think there was a mango tree there. This is the rest, the living room, all with really tall ceilings." And I say to him, "Well, don't you think that's completely incredible that you remember this from when you were three?" And he says, "Yes, but not only that, I also designed houses exactly like this. Yeah, it's incredible. I remember my Uncle Charles sleeping there, and I remember the dark wood, and I remember the open kitchen there. I remember, and then it was gone. They moved out in 53, and it was gone." And then in later portions of my sessions with him, he talks about being a youth in exile in Barcelona and loving exploring the streets there, sitting at the sidewalk cafes, so on and so on, all elements that now play a large part in his new urbanist theory. So he was very directly influenced by his childhood experience of place.
How do you help people, Toby, understand what it is they're really looking for in a place that suits them psychologically?
Well, I do take people through exercises like the ones that I did with Graves and Jenks and Duani. Loosely speaking, there are 9 exercises, 3 exploring their past, 3 exploring their present, and 3 exploring their future sense of place and home. And in doing so, I get them to dig deeper into this kind of environmental treasure chest. By exploring past history of place, I get them to kind of identify what I call the high positive associations they have with past place, and then use those high positives to envision ideal design. For example, you could just take out a piece of blank computer paper and do something called an environmental timeline, draw a line across the paper horizontally, and draw a timeline of large-scale places you've lived for 6 months or more, villages, towns, or cities. For example, I would say the first one on my timeline would be Jersey City, New Jersey, 0 to 2 years old, Englewood, New Jersey, 3 to 21 years old. And then after doing that, circle those places, or one place in particular from the past, that was your favorite place, and then use words to describe why it was your favorite place, like exciting city, remote woodland setting. Then when you do that, you begin to see these high positive associations you have with past place. And you can also look at the timeline from other points of view, like say, okay, well, did I live most of my childhood in the country in the city, just as you were trying to think about at the beginning of our talk, Carol. Well, okay, if you lived in one kind of place in your childhood, a different kind of place now, what does that mean? Which place did you like the most? And begin to look at all the information you're getting from the timeline to come up with an ideal vision. So it might be, for example, okay, my ideal home place is a small city with lots of historic architecture in a warm climate with friendly people. Well, if you live in New York City, maybe you should be heading to Charleston if that's what you've come up with. So it's a process that I take people through.
You're listening to Smart City. Our guest is Dr. Toby Israel. She is design psychologist and principal with Toby Israel Consulting and the author of the book Someplace Like Home. From the perspective of a design psychologist, I hear you saying that before we choose a place to live, we should do our best to understand those things that we most want in a place. We normally think about that as what we want in a place in terms of the physical layout of the place, or how many rooms we want and where they should be placed, or the colors of the room, or the kind of furniture. You're providing an overlay here, and I'm wondering how much the two or those three things are connected. And then this sort of layer of psychological comfort that you say we ought to be looking for.
I say that all of those things are important. In fact, I base my work on a theory of a humanistic psychologist named Abraham Maslow, who said we're all motivated to become what he called self-actualized human beings, whole, fulfilled people. And he said in order to become fulfilled, we needed to satisfy a hierarchy of human needs, from basic needs like food, water, shelter, and from there, esteem needs and so on. Well, I've kind of transposed this hierarchy into a hierarchy of home as satisfaction. And similarly, I say, in order to have a satisfying home, you need home as shelter. That's the first thing, even before you get to the color of the walls or the shape of the rooms. The roof obviously can't leak. It's got to be solid. And then up from there, we need to think about satisfaction in terms of the psychological aspect of the house, the social needs, and then the aesthetic needs on top of that. So really, it's all of those things. And for example, in today's day and age, with all the disasters that we're having, we see that it's not just the four walls, the bricks and mortar, that are important to people. It is this psychological or sense social place, home in that way, that's important to us. When we think about, for example, Katrina or a tsunami, that's what seems to be coming out for people.
Your methodology gives more weight to questions like, do you think your personality is reflected in your home, or do you feel comfortable that your home reflects who you really are, than is it physically comfortable? Does it work for your lifestyle?
Right.
So how do you balance those considerations?
Well, I think part of it is to become aware of the aspects of home that we don't usually think about. We're always told about, okay, you know, what colors do you want? We're bombarded by TV regarding how a house should, ought, or must look. But perhaps another thing to do is to think about, well, okay, who's in this house? What are those people like? For example, one of the exercises I do looks at whether or not a person's an introvert versus an extrovert. I'm more of an extrovert. I live in a house with lots of windows where I can look out. Other people I know are more introverts. They prefer more individual rooms than open space necessarily. So it's partly understanding who you are and then saying, okay, in fact, if we kind of take a magnifying glass approach, we're looking from afar to the kind of house that fits us in terms of the personality and who we are, in terms of the dwelling, then in terms of the individual rooms, in terms of the furniture, and then even in terms of the objects within it.
In your book, you talk about the importance of landmarks in your environmental autobiography. Tell me about landmarks and the role they play on your being comfortable in the place that you live.
Well, we all have, to use a word by Kevin Lynch, writer of Image of the City, we all have an image of our city or an image of our place. And there are different elements of city form that contribute to making that image. And one of them is landmarks, things that stick out in our mind. And those two stay with us from the past. So, for example, I grew up and went to school in a town that had this wonderful Tudor-style high school with a wonderful Tudor tower. And lo and behold, I live in a town that has a school that almost looks identical. So those things, those landmarks, hold real power and importance to us. And if they are special, there's no reason why we can't become aware of that, try to find places that similarly resonate with us.
We're seeing today people who grew up in the suburbs moving back to cities. In earlier generations, we saw the opposite trend. Is there any design psychology dissonance in making that kind of switch?
I think part of what's happening is we have more, many people have more disposable income. Their children have gone off. They're looking to a much more active lifestyle, and cities very often provide that kind of stimulation for us. So, again, it's a kind of not even just a physical thing. It's an emotional thing of, okay, we want to live an active and vibrant life into our later years.
You are often asked to be part of a team with designers, architects, to build places that people respond to enthusiastically. Can you characterize the advice you typically give to those professionals that they might not consider if you were not on the team? Where do you specifically add value?
Well, I think it is in looking at the social and psychological aspect of place. You know, architects and planners are trained in a certain way to look at the physical aspect, to look at numbers aspect, to look at financial aspect. But who on the team has the training to look at that social and psychological aspect of place? So part of what I do is actually involve the people who live in that place in kind of participatory process that helps them explain what it is or talk through what it is about a place that really makes that place vital to them. So, for example, again, we saw when it came to Katrina, people were talking about the fact that there were places that held so much history for them, that their ancestors lived there, that there was music there, that there was food there. So in terms of rebuilding, it's important to keep those social networks, to think about those things that are important to that culture. And you can only hear that through listening to people in the community. So part of what I do is draw community members together with architects, with planners, with politicians, with real estate developers, and so on, and do a kind of deep dive going all the way back to people's past history of place and using that as the catalyst for talking about future place.
And then how would the product look different as a result of architects, designers being part of that process?
Well, it really depends upon the individual situation, what it is that people say should be brought to the fore. For example, I did a project in Cincinnati where the theme was jazz. There was a long history of that neighborhood of music and also buildings around there that had to do with the Art Deco area. So when it came to designing the actual row houses, some of those had a kind of lively Art Deco style as well as more traditional style buildings. Also in relation to street names, those related to a jazz theme. So it's really taking that vision of the people, sharing it with the architect and planners as part of the design group, and having that them translate it into final design.
That's a surprising example you just cited, because I don't think of the example you just gave as emanating from design psychology. I think of it as emanating more from historical concerns, marketing concerns, heritage concerns, but not necessarily design psychology. So am I missing a link there, Toby?
Well, I think it's just in working with the individuals. In that particular case, it was taking what the developers were envisioning and saying, okay, does this resonate with you? Was this part of your heritage and so on? So there was a deeper dive involved there.
Is the use of design psychology only relevant for those who can afford their own architect and a lengthy design process when it comes to thinking about an individual home?
No, you don't need to go through a lengthy design process at all. In fact, I work with homeowners all the time who are not necessarily wealthy, taking them through this process and seeing what it is that they envision. And I know in my own home, for example, I found that it was the big woods of my childhood that really influenced me. And also, looking back at something called my environmental family tree, I saw that it was the Hungarian kitchen of my ancestors that I always heard about, which was kind of in a hut house, in a simple, earthy, vernacular style. So when it came to designing and remodeling my own kitchen, for example, I chose cabinets that had the same kind of orange color that reminded me of the Hungarian homes that I saw in later life. And I painted the kitchen the same white color that existed in my ancestors' home. And then I actually included a tree right in the middle of my kitchen, kind of put down on its side, sliced across the top. And it's a place where I can sit or rest and pretend in a way that I'm in the big woods. So none of this was any more expensive than any other kitchen project, remodeling project. It just was doing it from a kind of deeper, more authentic place.
Is this why furniture tends to reemerge in cycles? I mean, the blonde wood that was popular in the 50s reemerges in the 90s as trendy again?
Well, that's an interesting question. And one of the things I've speculated on, for example, if I were someone coming up with a new furniture line or design ideas, would you go not back to people's parents, but in relation to what I was saying about grandparents, would you reach all the way back to grandparents, see what was popular in those days, and bring that to the fore with the current generation? Would that resonate for people as a place of oasis, really? Because what I found in looking at why grandparents' home often came to the fore was it seems to be that's the place where the child gets spoiled, you know, in unconditional positive regard, and the parent gets a rest. So it's a wonderful place for everybody. And maybe those coming up with new styles of the moment should look back to people's grandparents' house rather than just even their parents' homes.
Toby, I want to thank you for being our guest on Smart City.
Thank you, Carol.
Dr. Toby Israel is the author of Someplace Like Home. After a short break, we'll return to talk with former Indianapolis Mayor Steve Goldsmith about his work in New Orleans, and we'll talk to Otis White about the latest news from cities. You're listening to Smart City. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Otis White runs Civic Strategies in Atlanta, and each week he brings us urban insights from around the country. Otis, as you do, I travel a lot around the U.S. talking with urban leaders, and everyone is talking about the problems of affordable housing, particularly as these housing prices have run up over the last 5 years. But is anyone doing anything about it?
Well, yes and no. They're talking about it, and that's a good thing because they're recognizing the magnitude of the problem. There are some reasons for guarded optimism about changes. We certainly hope there are changes ahead. But in large respects, these governments have created the problem that they're concerned about themselves. Just to sort of put the optimistic stuff out there, there does seem to be some lessening, meaning growing smaller in the NIMBY reaction that people have to affordable housing. Now, let me quickly differentiate here. There's two kinds of affordable housing that people talk about. One is for the poor, and one is for the middle class who simply can't afford to live in cities anymore, the firemen, the school teachers, and those sorts of folks. And so we're generally talking about that second group now. So there's some lessening of that NIMBY reaction against affordable housing. That is, I live in a neighborhood with $300,000 houses. I don't want people moving into $150,000 houses down the street. So there's a little bit of reaction to that. There's also apparently some greater success in new developments at mixing in some affordable housing units into more affluent units. So there's a little bit of encouragement there, but still we haven't tackled the big problem, which is that governments are making it virtually impossible to build middle-class housing in cities, and there's no particular reason that it should be impossible. What you have to do to make housing more affordable is to build on less land, and that this is conceivable. You can do it. In New York, they built quite affordable housing in the early 20th century in some of the most expensive land in Manhattan, and they did it by going up. We can do that in other cities. We just choose not to.
Well, it's a problem we need to get serious about because, again, it's certainly on the minds of every urban leader in America.
Absolutely.
Otis, we'll talk to you next week.
Thanks, Carol.
You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta, and this is Smart City. A noted urban innovator, Steve Goldsmith is the former mayor of Indianapolis. He is the Daniel Paul Professor of Government and Director of the Innovations in American Government Program at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. You have had an extraordinary opportunity to work with Mayor Ray Nagin in New Orleans as he tries to get that city back on its feet in the wake of Hurricane Katrina. We've seen the pictures. We've read the story, Steve. What are the most urgent tasks that remain for that city's leaders?
Well, I've had an interesting opportunity to look at it as part of the mayor's Bring Back New Orleans Commission, in part at the invitation of the business community and some individuals there. And so there's lots of urgent activity, which appears to be obviously necessary from television and radio and on the ground. And there's housing and city services and policing and crime fighting. But just let me back up for a second to the threshold question they asked, which is, you know, how should government work here? Because you clearly have a crisis where there were lots of problems and mistakes and failures at all levels of government. And then you have these urgent needs, but you have this kind of overarching question, which is New Orleans government, is regional government set up correctly? I mean, how do you provide the tools for strong leadership? So they've got urgent issues, and they've got structural issues, and they have a mayoral campaign, and they have folks without housing, and they have people scattered all over the country, and particularly in the South. And this is as interesting and complex and difficult a set of issues, I think, as any American city has seen in a long time.
Well, how did you answer the question? How should government work here?
Well, there is a perception, you know, that New Orleans, to some extent legitimate perception, frankly, New Orleans has had a lot of governance problems over the years. In addition, it's had it's a city with highly concentrated poverty, among the most concentrated poverty of any major American urban city before the problems with Katrina. And so there's some questions that would have been there regardless of the catastrophe, and then the catastrophe aggravates it. So now you have folks dispersed over the South. The role of the mayor first must be that city needs a leader. The role of a mayor is to make folks who live in the city and want to invest in the city confident that tomorrow will be better than yesterday. And if folks aren't confident that tomorrow will be better than yesterday, they're not going to invest, they're not going to come back, they're not going to rebuild the city. And so the fractious nature of New Orleans politics, with a highly involved consul that's often at odds with the mayor, and a series of often important issues that deal with corruption and transparency, the arguments between the city and the state, those things need to be realigned so that you have a clear spokesperson for rebuilding, which theoretically is the mayor, but made more complicated even by the impending election.
What was the structure of New Orleans government that you feel kept it from being the ideal government, the kind of government that can have a strong leader and transparent operations?
It's an interesting question. Let me first say that I think, and I've, as you know, spent a fair amount of time with mayors around the country for probably the last decade and a half or more. We have mayors in America with limited authority and mayors with great authority. We have city managers. We have strong mayors. We have consuls that are not intrusive. We have consuls that are intrusive. My first comment is much of it's personality driven. If a person wants to be the leader of the city and he or she can instill confidence, they can do it. You know, Mayor Franklin did it in Atlanta, coming off a very difficult time for Atlanta. We've obviously seen what Rich Daley has done in Chicago, Red Rendell, and when he was mayor of Philadelphia before he was governor, or Rudy Giuliani. And you can find in cities where, like Charlotte, where the mayor has very limited authority but personally is very involved, you can lead. So leadership doesn't necessarily have to be conditioned on authority. Having said that, however, it seems like a mayor is most likely to lead and instill confidence when he or she can actually accomplish something. And so that means a strong mayor and a council that is, on the ball with respect to how money is spent, but not intrusive in decision making, would be helpful. And in New Orleans, where zoning decisions are often overridden by the city council, where permitting decisions are overridden by the city council, where the city council may have its own agenda, very difficult for a mayor to lead in those circumstances.
And yet, council members, ostensibly, they're elected by the people of the city. And so what contribution is it that a council member, in your opinion, ideally makes?
Well, let's, of course, you know, I'm a former mayor, and of course, my definition of the contribution of a councilor is when he or she agrees with the mayor. That's probably not exactly what you meant, you know. In this case, you'd expect a councilor to be responsive and constructive, to watch for budget appropriations and set priorities. But the reason it's particularly difficult in New Orleans is the following. When you have a city that's devastated, you cannot rebuild the whole city at once. So there are going to be priorities that need to be made. Now, those priorities, there can be a priority inside each ward, so you don't have to pick rich versus poor and black versus white, but somebody has to allocate the resources of the city in order to begin work. In New Orleans, that's been a very difficult process because the council wants to control the redevelopment, the mayor wants to control the redevelopment, the governor wants to control the redevelopment, the federal government may or may not be involved depending on, you know, when it is and who's talking. So I think in this particular case, on you need to have a very strong executive with very substantial power on redevelopment, including eminent domain and zoning and the decision about infrastructure. The council needs to appropriate that money and hold the mayor accountable. But if it gets into an issue of the council fighting about fractious parochial interests, very problematic.
Now, some have recommended that responsibility for redevelopment be removed from the mayor and the council altogether and put into a new agency, a new redevelopment authority. What's your opinion on that?
Right. I think that's a very important question, and it goes to kind of the heart of urban governance. You know, there are these issues about corruption in New Orleans and issues in New Orleans, and they're all legitimate. But if you rebuild a city with a redevelopment agency that is separate from the city and separated from control of the city, it feels to me like you're just going to hollow out New Orleans' good government efforts even more. And that, yes, there ought to be controls, but that the redevelopment is inherently a local decision. Now, you may end up with a hybrid situation like you did in New York City when it went through its near bankruptcy and federal bailout, where there was an oversight committee, or in Washington, D.C. during its really difficult days where the federal government imposed an external CFO, if you will, on it. But I think to divorce the redevelopment, to take it up to the state level, for example, to create a regional redevelopment initiative that doesn't have substantial local control would be, in the long run, not in the best interest of the city.
What is it that we learned that you're now applying in New Orleans and that perhaps all cities could learn from?
These are interesting lessons, as you suggested. Let me talk about Washington, D.C. in response to your question. I'm involved in a redevelopment corporation on behalf of the mayor here to redevelop the Anacostia, and it's given me an opportunity to kind of look at the district. And I think this model is not a bad model. There's an independent CFO imposed by Congress, if you will, on the city. There was much more congressional control of the city than there is now. And essentially what they ended up with was this transitional process, which is, yes, we, Congress, will invest a fair amount of money in Washington, D.C., but we're not confident that local structures are there. But we don't want to preempt them altogether. So independent CFO, some oversight authority, and then as you hit certain benchmarks, you will take that authority back. And so then we saw Tony Williams, the current mayor, kind of came up through that independent CFO process. There's another excellent independent CFO now, Dr. Gandhi. Mayor Williams now obviously is mayor and has credibility and an honest reputation, and the city is doing well, and the city's been given back much more authority by Congress. And I think that kind of transitional process that says we're going to help you build up your capacity, we're going to impose accountability because you're spending our dollars, but allows you to transition to kind of a better state is probably the best model and not a bad one for New Orleans and Louisiana to consider.
How do you reconcile the imposition of those structures and those decision makers in a democracy, when you have elected officials who locally elected officials who are then overridden at some point by a higher authority?
These are really good questions. Unfortunately, they don't have very simple answers. I think we're dealing here with a very important question that affects all cities. Even ones that haven't been hit by catastrophe, and one that mayors across the country, as you know, are seeing with respect to the withdrawal of community development block grant funds. And that is, when one level of government spends money from another level of government, that it comes with strings and mandates that impede local control, but the money is so important because of its needs that local groups and mayors accommodate it. Then they become dependent on it, and then when it starts to be removed, they're upset about it. So, and this is just the same as, you know, revenue sharing when it was ended for cities. So I think the answer to your question is, if you're going to accept money from one level of government, then you have to expect it to come with some sort of accountability standards. However, the problem often is that it comes with mandates that make the money difficult to spend well or cause the money to be spent poorly. And so the balance is, how do you get money from one level of government, be held accountable for the performance, but not have those federal bureaucrats or state bureaucrats telling you how to spend the money, rather just holding you accountable for how well it's spent?
You are consulting in New Orleans. That's a city with race dynamics at work that you didn't have in Indianapolis, certainly not to the same degree. How do those race dynamics complicate what's going on in the city and the decisions that are being made? And let's face it, the trust in those decisions that are being made.
Race affects every decision in every major urban community in the U.S., and if you're a leader and you don't pay attention to it, you're not a very good leader. And diversity is important, and signals are important, and equity is important. And what you find, in most cities you find these under flashpoints between, either on police issues or education issues, but in New Orleans you find it on everything, essentially, is that there is a sense by those who are very, very poor that they're not being treated fairly, and often that's the case, not always, but often that's the case. And so when New Orleans received this report from the Urban Land Institute that said we're going to rebuild this ward before that ward, that was construed in a very racial framework. And I think the priority of funding and work and rebuilding and involvement needs to be sensitive to the fact that this is a city that has some substantial degree of polarization, and what you want to do is rebuild in a way that brings people back together, not separates them out. And so New Orleans has kind of lurched from suggesting it was going to abandon the African-American wards first to lurching to a view that the city was inherently African-American and was going to ignore the white citizens. And you can't rebuild the physical infrastructure without rebuilding the civic infrastructure and the fabric of a democratic society, and sensitivity and prioritization of the dollars and investments are highly important here.
You're listening to Smart City. Our guest is Steve Goldsmith. He is director of the Innovations in American Government program at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government and former mayor of Indianapolis. You brought up the ULI report, so let's talk about it a minute. Did the ULI report, the Urban Land Institute report, did it do more harm than good?
Well, there are very good people involved in the ULI report, and you know, I wasn't part of it. I kind of arrived there, you know, shortly after it was released, and people were still either discussing it or yelling about it, really depending on who they were. And I think the intent was good, which is you can't just willy-nilly rebuild the whole city, because everybody's seen the pictures on television, but as a practical matter, think about it this way. If your entire block is devastated, there has to be some tangible statement from government that this block is a priority and we're going to start rebuilding it next month. Otherwise, you penalize those homeowners who come in first. What if you come in first and rebuild your house and nobody else comes in to rebuild their houses for 2 years, or the city doesn't get the roads back together, or the sewers aren't working again? Then that person has invested their money and their house is going to depreciate. So the city has to set the tone for investment decisions. So something has to be done, and you can't do everything. But the Urban Land Institute report, I think, as it was construed, did a disservice, because instead of thinking in terms of how to set priorities in each ward, it suggested a structure that picked one ward over another. And you can imagine how inflammatory that is if your house is in one of the ignored wards. So I think the repercussions of that were quite unfortunate for the community, quite unintended by ULI, but a problem nevertheless.
Steve, does this raise the issue of business running public affairs? And I ask you that because so many times people will say, well, government should run like a business. And I know you pushed Indianapolis in a very innovative way to outsource work, to competitively bid contracts. And you had good results with that. But I'm just, there's also a sensitivity that government must right. have to people and their needs that that business doesn't necessarily have.
Right, right. You know, I wrote this book that you were kind enough to talk about in a previous show called Government by Network. And we talk about the role of government in this book, Government by Network. And the concept is government should manage itself through a series of networks, and the idea of considering government as a government official, as a manager of a bureaucracy, is outdated. Here is how, therefore, I'd answer your question. Government has the ultimate responsibility to referee fairness and equity and allocation of resources. That is government's role. It cannot be outsourced. And you can't turn over to a private company the decision about how much to charge for water so that folks who are poor can't get it, or where you're going to build. I mean, the function of government, particularly in an urban city, is to make sure that everyone is treated fairly. And so the question is, what should you outsource and what should you can control? And people get mixed up. They think that you can't control it if you outsource it. And the answer is, you can outsource the delivery of a service, but land use issues and permitting issues and eminent domain issues and other equity issues with respect to access to utilities, et cetera, need to be controlled very firmly and very fairly in a transparent way by government.
I want to ask you about the role of a mayor in economic development, but I want to ask you specifically as it pertains to New Orleans. I've seen figures, Steve, that suggest that people living in the Ninth Ward in New Orleans, 80% of them worked, and many of them had more than one job, which suggests that, you know, they were working in very low-wage jobs, probably that underpin the city's tourism industry.
Right.
That's a guess, but that's probably
a fair
yeah. assumption.
Yep.
Have you thought much, or has there been much talk among the Bring Back New Orleans committee about how you begin to rethink those jobs and add value to those jobs so that they command higher wages? This is not simply a problem for New Orleans. You know, it's a problem everywhere. And as union jobs disappear, as middle class jobs disappear or become very unstable, I mean, it seems to me we're in a precarious situation. We have to begin thinking about how we add value to low-wage jobs. Have you done any thinking about that? Did it come up in your deliberations in New Orleans?
You know, it's really too bad you do so much research with so many mayors, because you ask these questions that have absolutely no answers to them. I mean, this is the most fundamental question facing America's cities today, which is that the cities are still creating jobs and unemployment rates are you know, reasonably okay, given the fact that they're cities. But what cities are doing is they're replacing manufacturing jobs with service sector jobs. And when they do that, then the average family income in the city drops, and the total amount of wealth in the city is dropping. And as we offshore jobs and manufacturing jobs disappear, and the more cities, including Indianapolis, that have hospitality as a driving force of their economy for the service sector jobs, see this very difficult situation. Now, it may be a little bit more aggravated in New Orleans because the wages of the service sector may be a little bit lower, but nevertheless, it's a problem for every American city. It's a huge issue for New Orleans, in my opinion, because even though there's some very enlightened employers in New Orleans, Shell Oil's decision to stay there was a remarkable decision that could easily have been made to go to Houston. I mean, a very important decision, which holds some hope for the city. But this is a city that creates its jobs around the hospitality industry. And how do you get up the salaries of the hospitality industry? Well, I mean, the Service Workers Union would say it's through unionization, and maybe it is. But the problem is, this is a very competitive business. And if your hotel room rates go too high, if your setup charges for your staging go too high, then there's an oversupply of convention center space around the country, and you begin to be challenged, at least if you're a mid-market city, like in terms of conventions like Indianapolis or New Orleans or the case or other similar cases. So your question is terrific. You can create career ladders. You can create insurance pools. I think what Governor Romney did recently in Massachusetts with mandated insurance for everyone is a step in the right direction on these issues, but it's not an easily solved problem in the hospitality and service industries. Let me just say one other thing, Carol, that I think we did in Indianapolis that's worth thinking about. The added problem here is that the hospitality industry is fragmented. So some of these folks in the Ninth Ward in Indianapolis and Chicago, whatever, and I remember meeting these men and women when I was mayor. I mean, they work three or four jobs. They work, they work in the convention center in the day, and they work at a restaurant at night, and they work at a hotel on the weekend. I mean, they're doing whatever they can to keep their families' heads above water. And those jobs are not easily integrated. And if we create career ladders so that the new immigrant who is the maid during the day has a chance eventually to become the night clerk or the night assistant manager or the night manager. Career ladders created inside those industries are one hope that even though the wages are low at the beginning, they can actually matriculate up.
You're a guy who likes to get things done. You get things done. In your opinion, Steve, has the pace of bringing New Orleans back been unreasonably slow?
I could not believe it when I saw it. You know, I had in my mind, because I wasn't down there like the week after. I was down there sometime after. I assumed when I went down there that I would see a version of, you know, I remember from the as a mayor, the image I remember from the World Trade Center, I mean, after the disaster itself, was one dump truck after another coming out of the side hauling out debris. Like, This is an army of folks kind of rebuilding New York City with, you know, bold leadership and workers everywhere. And, you know, I went to New Orleans and there was like, you know, one pickup truck every five blocks. And there were kind of signs in the medium about who you could hire. And I mean, the most important indicia of confidence is activity. And I think the pace is just unconscionably slow.
Do you want to say why you think that is?
Well, I mean, I went down there to help, not to be critical. I mean, and I guess there's, you know, plenty of blame to pass around. I mean, and it kind of a little bit goes back to kind of yet. If you're going to start, you got to start somewhere, and if you start somewhere, then you make somebody else mad. I mean, so there's some of that. But having said all that, leadership starts at home, you know. And although there's plenty of federal and state issues to be resolved, and private business issues to be resolved, I always viewed it as. No matter who else to blame, ultimately, the mayor's the one that has to be the leader for creating momentum and activity.
Steve, I appreciate you sharing your insights from your work in New Orleans. Thanks for being with us on Smart City.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Steve Goldsmith is the director of the Innovations in American Government program at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. CityView's commentator Walker Smith joins us weekly to give us his very personal view of life in cities.
I am ashamed to say that I can't remember the last time I sent a handwritten thank you note. Growing up, my mother made me sit down after every birthday and Christmas to write a note thanking each person who had given me a present. She also made me write thank you notes after parties I attended and even for social occasions I was invited to but was unable to make. These notes were written on the personalized stationery my mother had had printed up just for this purpose. I always grumbled about the time and effort, but my mother insisted that was exactly the point. It wasn't what I wrote so much as the fact that I wrote anything at all. The time it took to write a short note was more than just an expression of thanks. It was a reciprocation in kind of the time and expense that my friend or host had given to me. I am no less thankful these days than I was growing up. I just seem to be more pressed for time and less able to spare a free moment. Most of the time, I manage to get off an email saying thanks, but it's not the same. It just seems to me that email isn't as genuine as a handwritten note. Maybe that's my mother talking, but the note she made me write always conveyed the regard and respect that I owed people and that they recognized and appreciated. I don't think respect is any less important these days. In fact, it's more important than ever. A 2002 Public Agenda poll found that less than half, only 48%, said they quote-unquote sometimes encounter people who say please and thank you. 16% said never. This is consistent with a 1998 Gallup poll in which only 30% said that they make a point of saying thanks, quote-unquote, some of the time. We don't want to take the time to give our respect to others, yet we notice when others don't do that for us. There's something terribly self-centered about this. But it's not hard to remedy. We just have to make the effort. Even a small effort will do. While I worry about email, at least for small gifts and gestures, it's okay. In a 2001 Emily Post Institute survey, 70% said that for small things, an email thanks is appropriate. But for bigger things, it takes a handwritten note. And that's in our selfish interest, too. For example, a 2005 survey by CareerBuilder.com found that nearly half of hiring managers would reject or think less of a job candidate who failed to say thanks. And something other than email is expected by nearly two-thirds. So I have resolved to get back in the habit. My stationery is on order. I've got a nice pen ready, and I'm trying to remember how my mother taught me to write them. I suppose I should write her first, though, and thank her for a lesson that only now am I able to appreciate. For City Views, this is Walker Smith.
Walker Smith is president of Yankelovich, Inc. He comes to us from Georgia Public Radio in Atlanta. Join us online at smartcityradio.com to sign up for a podcast of our show and register for our weekly newsletter. You can also find there our archive shows. Our theme music was composed and performed by Memphis musicians Robbie Grant and Steve Selvage, with additional music by Chris Reyes. Eric Rudd edits Smart City. Smart City is a production of WKNO in Memphis. I'm Carol Coletta.